Martin Amis was born in Oxford in 1949 and is a British novelist, essayist, and memoirist, all of whom show up to share in the writing of his latest novel, Inside Story. Amis is best known for his novels Money and London Fields. He received the James Tate Black Memorial Prize for his memoir Experience and has been nominated for the Booker Prize twice. He served as professor of creative writing at the University of Manchester until 2011 and is considered one of the most influential novelists of our time. We met via Zoom to talk about everything he throws into this novel, plus the way he frames it. The conversation starts mid-sentence with the two of us talking about Chip Kidd's dust jacket design.
I took the cover off because I didn't want to wreck it.
But I assume it's like the American one.
Yes, you're there, but one of your eyes is cut off on the image, and you could be looking at someone with a threatening glance.
Right. Yeah, I remember.
And I just wonder if that was intentional or why he chose it, or you just liked it.
No, I just okayed it. I don't get very intimately involved in decisions like that.
So it doesn't really matter. You're going to sell a jitload of books anyway. Is that it?
No calculations of that kind either. Having done this for 50 years, that all seems very external now.
Right. Okay. The title of the book, The Inside Story, why did you choose to give us the inside story on your life? And how to do what you've spent your life doing?
Well, there's no definite article. It's just called Inside Story. And that refers to my life, but also to the business of putting a story together and putting prose together. So there's a modest double meaning there.
Yeah. But why do you want to tell this inside story?
It becomes... A certain pressure builds up in you, and you do want to tell this story. And I wrote a memoir 20 years ago, which was a straight memoir, not chronological, but
experience.
Yeah. But this time I thought, well, I'm not doing that again. So it's called a novel, and I believe it is a novel, and I think of it as a novel. And that changes everything. As well as making it much more difficult to write. A straight memoir comes at about twice the rate of a novel. And the rate of a novel is 100 pages a year, very roughly. So I made life more difficult for myself, but more interesting, I thought.
It seems to me that you've thrown everything at this. You've got literary criticism in there. You've got autobiography. You've got short biography. You got short stories. You've got you've really stretched. Well, I haven't stretched it because a novel is free, isn't it? There's no definition of it really.
It's elastic. D.H. Lawrence talked a lot of rubbish about many things, but he did say the great thing about the novel is you can do anything with it, and that's true enough. There are no laws imposed on you. You can find your own way.
You know, one of the things that you say is that you would like the reader to dip in and out of it and go back and forth and postpone. And that's not typically how you read a novel.
No, and I don't think anyone has read it that way.
I have.
Dipped in and out of it.
Well, yes, I raced through some of it. I got into a bit of a car accident a couple of days ago, and that screwed up my reading schedule. So I flipped back and forth and went to the front, went to the back, reread. I did exactly what you ordered.
Well, you're free to do that, absolutely. But it's, as you've noticed, no doubt, it is a book about the reader as well.
Well, in fact, I have a question about Calvino, If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler, is pretty well the same idea. It's inviting a reader into the room and examining the romance between the writer and the reader in a kind of postmodern way. Were you informed by that?
No, I know the title. It's pretty hard to forget that title, but I haven't read Calvino. But no, you alarm me by saying it begins with him inviting the reader into the room, because that's how I begin too. So it's a happy coincidence rather than intentional.
Lolita begins with an interesting foreword written by John Ray, PhD, and he describes Humbert, whose manuscript it's supposed to be, as a horrible leper who writes in a way that betrays a supreme misery. And it seems to me that Nabokov was trying to distance himself from perhaps the perversion of the character, despite the fact that many people might assume that it was him. So I just have a question, because I know that Nabokov is extremely important to you and you reference him throughout the book. Why do you think Humbert wrote this manuscript to justify his behavior? And is that why you're writing this book?
Well, no, I have nothing to justify. I mean, in that I have not enslaved a 12-year-old girl.
Didn't Phoebe enslave you, or no, guess not?
He's 35 years old, not 12. Well, nothing I confess to. There are a few confessions dotted along the way, but I can hardly hide behind a bogus academic, as Nabokov pretends to do. Don't forget, and this is a theme in the novel, you could go to jail for writing that book in the 1950s. And when they were about to publish Lolita in London, the publishers were prepared to go to jail.
Weidenfeld?
George Weidenfeld. And I quote the Philip Larkin poem, Sexual Intercourse Began in 1963, which was rather late for me, between the end of the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP. Now, until the Chatterley ban was overturned, which it was in, I think, 61 or 2, writing about sex, which is very problematic, partly for that reason still today, was illegal, and that you feared the policeman's knock as you wrote about sex. Well, that no longer applies and stopped applying in the 60s. But it's not accurate to think that all those inhibitions disappeared with the legal ban. And in fact, it's something I think we still haven't successfully done, which is writing well about the transcendental element of sex that we all know is there. And it is an extraordinary subject in that sex is the force that peoples the world.
It is. In fact, it's interesting. You suggest that fictional success in dreams, sex, and religion is exceedingly rare. Now, I would suggest that death is closely connected to religion. And I think the best writing deals with death. Tolstoy on death is unchallengeable. And I think Nabokov on sex, even though it's a perverted masturbation, is some of the best writing I've ever read. And Molly Bloom's monologue is about sex.
Very largely. Yeah, I've said elsewhere that novels that are all about sex, as Lolita is, in most important regard, at least then it comes as a unity. The trouble with most writing about sex is that the writer goes off into the sex scene.
Yeah.
And it's a complete intrusion, and it's not linked to anything else in the novel. And then when the sex scene is over, you see the writer sort of thinking to himself, well, where was I? You know, let's get back.
That's right. Clears your throat and yeah.
sorry about that, but let's get back to the story. Well, that's no good. That defies the unities of writing. That's a trouble, I think, not with Lolita. But you know, he wrote, I think it is, five novels with a nymphette featuring very strong. They're all 12 years old. And that is indiscipline, I think. And the last three novels are all about that. It's the great blot on Nabokov's corpus that there is this sort of preponderance, these nymphette-infested late novels, a loss of he ceases to treat, to honor the honor of 12-year-old girls. I think Lolita itself is irreproachable, very complicated morally, but it does work out. And the same cannot be said for Ada or the original of Laura or Look at the Harlequins, where it does feel like an intrusion.
Yeah, it's almost the fact that he had a personal experience at a young age, I think, didn't he? And that may well, even though you're not really supposed to connect the author with the work, it's hard not to here.
Well, there's that first love. That's the story called First Love.
Yeah.
And he mentions it, well, he talks about it in Lolita, and she died very young of, I think, typhus.
Yeah.
He gives himself the fairly convincing excuse that his libido was stalled by this intense love followed by death. And that is why he's fixated on these 12-year-olds. But that'll do for one novel. It won't do for six.
Yes. So as I say, it's really hard not to connect the fiction with the fact.
Well, there's absolutely no evidence that it ever intruded into his life. And I know certain writers, John Banville, for instance, who said that it wouldn't matter if that were established, that he'd been arrested for molestation or...
No, I'm not even suggesting that. I'm just suggesting that his experience when he was young was life-forming, and he was obsessed. I'm not suggesting he was a pedophile. I'm just saying that he had a life experience that was so gigantic that he couldn't stop himself from writing about it.
Well, there's no evidence, or I don't know where the evidence is that the same thing happened to the young Nabokov. It's there as a device in Lolita to account for this obsession, lay the ground for that obsession. But it became a habit. That's the trouble. He wrote 18 novels. Six of them are about 12-year-old girls. Three of those novels are masterpieces: Lolita, The Enchanter, and Transparent Things. So it's a very, I call it the problem from hell in Nabokov, in that it puts the reader in an awful position, in that you suspect, as we've been suspecting, that there must be some correlation between the life and the work. And that becomes pretty well unignorable if there are six. If a third of your corpus is about this, then it's unwieldy, to say the least.
Yeah. Just getting back to my question about Humbert. He's in prison at the time of writing the manuscript for Lolita. Do you think he's writing it to justify his behavior? Why do you think he's writing it?
Well, to redeem his behavior, that at least an immortal novel is going to be the fruit of this. I think it's in that little introduction, that bogus introduction, that he reveals the salient moral fact about the novel. And it's very heavily disguised in the preface. But he says, Mrs. Richard F. Schiller, which is Lolita's married name, he's telling you what happened to various characters in the novel.
That's right. They're dead, right?
Yeah. And he said she died in childbed, giving birth to a a stillborn girl in the town of Grey Star in the remotest northeast. And he said elsewhere that Grey Star is the moral capital of Lolita. Now, that is a resounding revelation that her natural functions were so deformed and distempered by her experiences with Humbert that she couldn't have the baby girl. She died, so did the baby girl. You know, a real brick wall of denial of later life. It's all very carefully prepared in the novel, and there's a great deal of death in Lolita.
Yeah.
Many of the main characters, starting with Charlotte Hayes, Lolita's mother, come to an unpleasant end before their time. And he says, I think in the last lines of the novel proper, he says that at least I can turn this into art, and this may be the only immortality we can share, my Lolita. It is a novel about love. I mean, Lionel Trilling was right. It's not a novel about a sexual perversion. It's a novel about love trapped in a 12-year-old girl. Morally very complicated, but intelligible and lucid.
Yeah, and he hates himself for it.
He says, if I'd been a judge of my own crime, I would have given me 35 years for rape and dismissed the other charges, which include murder of his rival, Quilty. That is the crime, as he sees it, rape.
Yeah, even though he's arrested for the murder.
Yeah, well, it is statutory rape. There's no question about that. I mean, she's 12.
Yeah. So we established that Lolita is full of death. Your book was what? Facilitated by Christopher Hitchens' death?
Yes, in a way. I've been struggling with it. I struggled with it for a couple of years and then put it aside. And then felt a slight loosening of the constrictions that unavoidably apply to autobiographical fiction. A genre I've never been at ease with. It now has the heading life writing, and is an enormous, more than a genre, sort of an alternative way of writing where you don't make anything up. So for me, it was never more than semi-viable, that way of writing. But when Christopher died, none of the writers I concentrate on in this book were alive. So there was a lessening of self-consciousness and pressure, and I was able to move ahead with it. It also gave me my theme, which was death. I'd noticed the absence of a coherent theme, and he provided me with that.
Okay. You welcome the reader into your home at the beginning using this sort of framing technique. Why did you do that?
Well, I wanted to concentrate up to a point on the relationship between the writer and the reader, which is quite mysterious and philosophically complicated. It's not a simple matter, and it is, the whole operation is dependent on that. And the reader is an artist up to a point, in that every reader will have a different image of, say, Madame Bovary. The reader does particularize in a way that the writer can't possibly have intended, because it's to do with the reader's memories and general sensorium.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You've written your book. I've read our book.
Yeah, it is a joint enterprise.
There are as many books out there now as there are readers, in effect.
It sometimes feels that way, yes. But when Nabokov was asked about the pleasures of writing, he said they exactly correspond to the pleasures of reading. It's the apprehension of of a different mind and a different scheme of things. And it's a then it's an interaction between writer and reader.
Nabokov says that great reading is rereading. And I think that great writing is or involves rewriting.
Oh, yeah. That is why the stream of consciousness is such a, in my view, degraded form. It's as if you never did the final drafts. You know, you just blurted it out and left it at that. And that's why success is in the stream of consciousness are very rare. About 20% of James Joyce is successful stream of consciousness. The rest is a drag, frankly.
Yeah. So I would say that Mully's monologue is some of the most beautiful writing we have.
Yeah, that is a success. But much of the Stephen Dedalus stream of consciousness is just like being with a terrible old bore.
And Finnegan's Wake is just incomprehensible.
Forget it, yeah.
The book was something, not that it was necessarily better back then, but the book was something to be savored, respected, enjoyed in the company of the author. So are you inviting the reader into the calm of your house to escape this scrambled, moronic inferno of Trump and fake news and distraction and stress?
Yeah. And I think, you know, whether you invite the reader into your house or not, that is what is on offer. It's an island of well-organized thought and feeling, unlike the random scattershot that we normally experience.
The thoughtless.
Yeah.
Yeah, at one point you suggest that the reader that you invite into your home is actually a younger you.
Yeah, and a more feminized me too, less locked into a gender role than I would normally feel. And, you know, life writing is a response to the great democratization that we're living through, where, you know, every man and woman has a voice and their own feelings,
yeah,
as important as anyone else's, and a great egalitarian push of the novel.
Well, I mean, most people's lives I really am not that interested in. I'm interested in the lives of people who have accomplished something.
That usually is a precondition for writing a memoir or an autobiographical novel. Although there are a few jewels of autobiography, I can't think of one at the moment, by people who are not notably distinguished.
I can think of one about sex, and it's my, what was it? It was The Victorian Gentleman. It was about his sexual exploits. Anyway, he wasn't anyone notable other than the fact that he had a lot of sex. I think it was published by Grove.
Yeah.
My Secret Life. My Secret Life, I think it was called.
Frank Harris, is that what you mean?
No. This was an anonymous character. I had great fun reading it as a teenager.
Yes, well, it doesn't take much to titillate a teenager.
Do you think that as the fact that you're a younger reader, you want this character to be a younger you, because he's someone with a capacity to escape into imagination more easily or escape time and space more easily?
No, much cruder than that. It's just that they're going to be around for a long time. And if you make the assumption that the reader is going to go on reading you, then that is a tiny measure of immortality or at least continuity that we're always searching for in our lives. And I think that's why partly one of the many reasons we have children is to make the story go on so that it doesn't stop dead with your own demise, that it proliferates.
There are other works that use this sort of framing device that you have, famous works like Canterbury Tales or even the Odyssey and the 1001 Arabian Nights. It's a string of fairy tales. And Nabokov says that all great novels are great fairy tales. What do you think he means by this?
Well, that's his... one of the key words in Nabokov is enchantment. And one of his novels about nymphets is called The Enchanter. That is a very unifying notion in Nabokov, that you do sort of escape from your life into another life through the imagination. And it is a kind of enchantment, as is love.
It's mystical, it's wonderful.
Yeah, and it's not of the everyday. It really is something that won't happen to you very often or very durably in your life, usually.
Yeah. So are the stories in Inside Story fairy tales?
No. I've written a novel or two that felt like fairy tales, but this is, I plant my feet very firmly in social realism, and I think that is the genre and everything else is, you know, often of interest and amusement, but the basic business of the novel is summed up in the magnum opus of one of the great social realists of all time, which is Anthony Trollope, who called his magnum opus The Way We Live Now. And that title could serve for any social realist novel of the last few centuries. Is the great subject. I sense that very early in my life when I was wondering about my father and what sort of novel he wrote. And, you know, for all I knew, he could have been writing Westerns or Bodice Rippers. But of course, I did sense that, no, he would be writing about the way we live now. Something I think tremendously worth doing.
Why is that?
Just because it's something we're all always working on, is how to live, how we end up living. And also the social framework for that is of great interest, and how it changes over time, and the dominant morality of the time, new freedoms and new dangers.
Especially right now.
Yeah, I think so. Well, it's always especially now. That's the nature of the thing, is that the present is always the most intense and the most turbulent.
In the introduction to his lectures on literature, Nabokov explains what a scholar might be if one knew well some half a dozen books. So it's clear that you exalt or elevate Nabokov, Bellow, Larkin. Who else, if you were to make six?
You want me to name three more? Contemporaries. Do you mean contemporaries or from the canon?
No. Anyone?
Oh, well, Jane Austen, Trollope, Dickens, George Eliot. I mean, Joseph Conrad, the great tradition.
Yeah. Okay, let's throw in a few contemporaries.
Don DeLillo. I don't read my contemporaries. I better say.
Oh, I know. You've said something like you want to wait till they become tested by time, right?
Wait till they're dead, basically. The dead is quite good advice. It's much more economical use of your time. Because the only value judgments that matter are not those you read in your newspapers or in your weekly magazines. They're the judgments handed out by time. There is no other measure of value than longevity.
Yeah, I agree. Nabokov says that great works of art create new worlds. So are you giving us a new world with Inside Story or not?
I don't think I am, no. it's certainly not new to me. It's life writing. Which never does surprise the author. May surprise the reader, but not the author. And I've written novels that have surprised me, those that depend on a much greater leap of faith earlier on.
Yeah.
And it is quite a sort of Promethean thing to do, to create a world. And that is the real excitement of writing a novel, is assigning life to these characters and these propositions. That's quite a strenuous gamble. And that is the real excitement, I find. It feels daring to me.
Okay, can you give us an example of how writing Inside Story as a novel helped you in a way that writing it as a memoir or autobiography wouldn't?
Well, yes, I can. I feel more and more as I get older that writing fiction is essentially an expression of freedom. And that is why writing about your own life automatically reduces your freedom to a fraction of what it is when you write wholly imagined, when you create wholly imagined worlds.
And that's because what? You've got the limits of the facts of your life. Is that it?
That's it. And also, it used to amaze me that Sorbello, who I think is the only writer who's really got somewhere with this writing about real people and real events. He was shackled by anxieties having to do with getting
legal,
getting sued, offending people, losing friendships, just, you know, natural delicacy that you don't want to be horribly indiscreet about your friends. It's a struggle to maintain decorum when you're writing about real things. You can't arrange matters. So why I was liberated by the death of Christopher was that I didn't have to worry about that, except, well, I did, but at a greater distance. It wasn't an immediate concern. And also I could rearrange things, and I didn't change any facts, but I changed the patterning and it felt a little bit more like a regular novel and not just a reworking of things I'd looked at before.
We mentioned the fact that you had suggested that the reader read your book in fitful bursts with plenty of skipping and postponing and doubling back, and of course, frequent breaks and breathers. And when I read that, I'm not sure why, well, maybe I am, I thought about your sex with Phoebe Phipps. And I'm thinking specifically about the postponing part, the sexual famines that you talk about.
Yeah, well, I might as well, I've said it before, I might as well admit that Phoebe Phelps is in fact a completely invented character. I did have some idea of making her an anthology of the girlfriends I had in my 20s and early 30s. But then as soon as you unleash this new character, then she will take over and she will expand and accrue to herself more and more autonomy. And I'm glad to say that's what happened. So that is all imagined, the famines. Although I did think it was an interesting idea and and not a bad strategy for overcoming, you know, the familiarity, which is the great enemy of love.
Yeah, absolutely. And very unusual.
Yeah.
Well, I love how you moved in on her. I just hope that was real life and you didn't make it up at the telephone booth. Please tell me that was real.
No, it was real, but with a different girl.
Could you just recount that very quickly? Because it's so good.
Well, it's what happened to me once, and probably happened to everyone. I walked past the telephone booth and noticed this young woman inside it, and walked on for a few yards and then paused and then doubled back and began to sort of shake my pockets for change and just queued, a one-man queue outside the telephone box, as I'd done in real life. And it was just being very surprised by the strength of the attraction. And she asked him a bit later, "Do you do this sort of thing all the time?" You know.
Well, I've got the actual quote. She said, "Do you do a lot of this trolling street corners on the off chance?"
There's no, because it's too nerve-wracking.
Yes, you did, yeah.
You make yourself utterly vulnerable when you do that.
And you also write that she reminded you of a little fox dressed as a forest ranger. Can you explain that?
Well, that's what my father said of her. And say that of a girlfriend of mine, a fox in a sort of green suit. You know, you can imagine it in a children's book. And he said he was very enamored of such a creature when he was a little boy. So again, it's like the Nabokov thing. You know, it awakens something in the polymorphous perverse that has a regrettable hold on you.
You also called her a terrorist. That's a Hitchens thing, is it?
Yeah, that was my first wife. He said of my first wife that she was a terrorist. And this was in 1980, before terrorism was on all our lips, although it was centuries old phenomenon. And what he meant by that, Christopher Hitchens, he meant a woman who is certainly not going to be crushed or stifled or drowned out by the male voices around her. She will stand up for herself. And that was a very attractive quality in 1980. I date the sexual revolution from around 1970. The women who entered into it, I mean, the men certainly went along with it in great euphoria, basically. And you could tell it was something that was happening on a broad scale, that it wasn't, that indeed it was a great social change that was coming over a whole society. And people said, "Oh, surely you didn't sense that." And I said, "Oh, yes, all of us did. It was like the wild beasts gathering to cross a river, and they're all on the shore of the river, and then at some sort of signal, they all rush forward and thrash through the water." And that's what it felt like.
Who was the wildebeest there?
Everyone.
Male or every female?
Well, certainly it couldn't have been done by males alone.
I'm wondering who scared them into jumping into the water.
It was just getting the impetus to do it and then the nerve to do it. And discovering the flimsiness of interdictions. They say you can't do this. And we've seen time and again in history where certain people have said, "Why can't I?" And then they defy it and the heavens don't open and life goes on. And you suddenly realize, so that was just sort of propaganda, all the other stuff. And just to round that off, it was why everyone, all the men my age and many of the women, had such difficult relationships with their parents around that time. Because the fathers in particular, fathers and sons, didn't apply to me, but it applied to all the men I knew, including Christopher. It's that the fathers looked at the sons as the sexual revolution began. And the first plank on the platform of the old regime was that there will be no sex before marriage.
Right.
When they look at their sons and think, I thought there was meant to be no sex before marriage. And although here unfolding in front of them. And that must have been a very bitter realization that they'd been duped, that they'd succumbed to propaganda, and there was no earthly reason why they had to obey those edicts. It was just force of societal habit.
Of the church.
Slackening its grip.
Hitchens called his father the commander.
He was Commander Hitchens.
I think I read once that Christopher's death provided you with an incentive to live larger.
Oh, no, I didn't. That doesn't ring a bell.
You wanted to get the most out of life.
Well, yes, but you do that by loving it, not by climbing Everest. Just by, in fact, even narrowing your gaze onto little details and little quirks of life, and seeing their comedy and beauty. And his death certainly did have that effect on me, as I think the death of a relatively young friend always does, that if they've been cut off, then you have an increased duty to, well, Christopher was a tremendous lover of life, more passionate than me. But when he died, I sort of took that responsibility on, as did his widow. And we agreed about this not long after he died, that our love of life had intensified since then.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was getting at.
Yeah. And I said to her, I feel slightly guilty. Do you think he'd mind that we're not just, you know, lying around totally demoralized, and that in fact we feel slightly rejuvenated by his death? And she said, no, he would have loved that. And I saw at once that that would have been true. So that too is a reciprocal feeling. Even though he's dead, his ghost is happy that we moved on, fortified from his life.
Do you feel any desire to be his Boswell?
No. No, I've got my own stuff to do. No, we're all our own Boswells.
Yeah, that's good.
Be undignified to subjugate yourself to a Dr. Johnson.
Well, Boswell got immortality because of it.
True, but it's a sort of secondary immortality.
Throughout the book, and we're winding down here, throughout the book, you use this device whereby you say there'll be more to come, or there'll be more to say, or wait for it. It's coming later on in the novel. I don't think that was necessary. Why did you put all those things in there?
Well, I can't think of many examples of it. Well, writers are always doing that. I mean, Melville in Moby Dick is constantly saying, well, I'll tell you this now, or I'll delay telling you this, or now is as good a time as any to tell you this. There is a great pressure on space in a novel, and finding out what goes where is one of the tasks or even chores of writing a novel. So it's constantly on your mind.
Yeah, and you suggest that plots and hooks set the reader a question with the implicit assurance that the question will be answered. That put me in mind of, you know, the gun on the wall in Chekhov short stories. So what question did you pose in this novel?
Well, all sorts of little questions. I don't use a hook. I don't really use a plot, because the plots belong to fiction, and to most often to genre fiction. Our lives don't have plots, but they do have little mysteries. Phoebe Phelps, for instance, has a secret that much of the novel is spent unlocking. And that is the essence of suspense, is not knowing the answer to something.
Yeah, it wasn't quite clear. Did you sleep or have sex with those two escorts to, in effect, bring about the end of your relationship with Phoebe?
No, they precede Phoebe.
That's me jumping around then.
Yeah. It is. Yes, I did.
I just want to say that I've followed you and Christopher really closely over the years. I've watched all sorts of video interviews that you've done and read much of what you've written. And it's just been really a thrill to connect with you. It's kind of surreal for me.
Well, that's nice to know.
And it's like I know you guys. It's kind of strange, isn't it?
It is. And that's an aspect of the reader-writer relationship that I like and value, is the intimacy. I don't know the intimate thoughts of my readers, of course, but if they're good readers and loyal readers, then I know quite a lot about them.
Well, Auden said something along the lines of, I like friends who are loyal and kind, but I love friends who can make me laugh. And boy, you have made me laugh over the years, I must say. Thank you for that.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
Nicola Six, in particular, when God was wanting to have sex with her, there was some line in there that just I screamed out loud.
Well, I'm very glad to hear it.
Just finally, I've told this story quite a few times. We were in New York maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It was a hot summer day, and I was wearing shorts and a grubby top that I'd spilt some hot dog relish and ketchup on. But I checked to see what was on in town that evening, and we were staying out in Staten Island. And it turns out that you were giving a talk that evening about hooligans at football matches. And it was a fairly upscale club, but I called up and told them that I hosted this podcast. And they let me in sight unseen. At intermission, you had snuck off for a cigarette, and I cornered you. I just figure you must have thought, what a yob, when I invited you to participate in this podcast way back when. I don't imagine you remember that. Anyway.
You were covered in relish and ketchup.
I was, yes. I didn't look too presentable. But anyway, all of that to say, it's been a real pleasure, and thank you so much for taking the time to connect with me.
Always nice to meet a good reader.
Very good. Thanks again.
All the best.
And to you.
Hope to see you in Montreal.
Very good.